to record this interview, please, sir?
Yes, you do.
Very good. Jim, do you have anyone else there with you?
Nope, just me.
All right. My name is Tom. Last name is Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, and I'm an assistant director of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and I'm going to have everybody here in this room with me identify themselves and ask them to spell their last name.
You know me, Jim, Kirsten Downey, D-O-W-N-E-Y.
And I'm Alexis Simendinger, and that's spelled S-I-M-E-N-D-I-N-G-E-R, and I'm part of the writing team also here at the FCIC.
Jim, by way of background, the FCIC was established by statute and signed into law by the president. It's a bipartisan committee and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and the collapse or near collapse of the major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the president and Congress by 15 December 2010. Jim, be advised that FCIC is an agency of the United States government, and FCIC employees are federal employees under the aegis of 18 U.S.C. Code 1001 concerning false statements, which means basically you can't tell us a lie. And I don't anticipate that you would, but I'm required by this format to advise you of that. Do you understand that, Jim?
Yes, I do.
Very good. Give us
so I would add, plenty of people in your end of the world told lots of lies to lots of folks, but I'm glad you gave me that caveat. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. But go ahead, Kirsten.
Jim, I want to just sort of let you start by telling us a little bit about Cleveland's experience. And I know this has really been, you've really seen a lot there. But tell me when did the financial crisis first come to Cleveland?
Well, I would say, by way of background, I was a city councilman in Cleveland for 19 years. I was elected to the office of county treasurer back here in 1996. It took office in March of 97. I became aware of this really for the first time when I was approached by a number of members of Cleveland City Council who crossed over from the City Council building to come and see me here at the County Administration building. I thought just to chat, who really came over to say, there's something going on out here that we've never seen before. We all knew what flipping was, but this was flipping on mega steroids. And they basically said, that we'd always had this problem of people who'd go in and buy a house on Monday, sell it on a Friday for an inflated price, typically doing very little or no work. Typically it involved collusion of a banker and a broker and another seller or buyer rather. But so we had seen that, but this was different. This was houses that were being bought and sold and going into foreclosure at a record rate. It's the first time I began to understand the process of securitization. There were a couple of people here. Well, we're talking the summer of 2000 in Cleveland, one named Patricia McCoy and the other named Kathleen Engel, both professors at Marshall Law School here, were well-versed with this issue of securitization and what was going on. At that point, we convened a meeting with a lot of community leaders, and we got the sense that if anybody had the ability to deal with this, it would have been the Federal Reserve Bank. We knew a little bit about a law passed in 1994 called the Homeownership Equity Protection Act. We thought that in that 94 law, the Fed had been given some authority, but more than anything, we thought, given the fact that this was a real banking crisis, that we needed to get to the Fed. Now, by way of background, I would tell you that reference point is that the average number of private mortgage foreclosures in this town averaged between 33 and 3,500. The foreclosures in 2000 settled in at about 7,000 for Cuyahoga County, or about twice as many, more than twice as many as there had been in the earlier part of the decade, by 94, 95. So they had more than doubled in 7 years. So we approached the Federal Reserve Bank, asked for a meeting, and we'd agreed that we would hold a seminar here or a conference. And we did in March of 01, entitled Predatory Lending in Ohio. We were able to get, as our keynote speaker, the Fed governor from Philadelphia, whose name has now escaped me, who passed away about 2 years ago.
It's not important.
Well, the Fed governor, who was one of the only Fed governors we learned who had really been kind of raising the alarm ringing the bell on this. So we had a huge conference here. Attended.
Did you mean he was from Philadelphia?
Gramlich.
Ed Gramlich, now deceased.
He is the one.
Right, yes.
He was our keynote speaker, and we deliberately got him because our contacts in the Fed said this is a guy that gets it.
Yes.
So we had a huge conference here at Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, helped to sponsor it on what strategies we should undertake. And I naively believe that they would go back to Mr. Greenspan, and, you know, presto, we'd have some new rules and regs to slow down, especially the non-depository banks. Who we think at the cause of so much of the problem. But I learned then I was pretty naive. Nothing happened. Cleveland, Dayton, and Toledo, all out of desperation, passed anti-predatory lending laws in 2001, only to have the state legislature here convene quickly to pass preemptive legislation. And at that point, really, there was no sheriff left in town, and these foreclosures just continued to take off through 1996. By the way, we led the country in 2000. Statistically, I think you'll see, or first or second, typically between 2000 and 2006. The last year we led the country in private mortgage foreclosure was the year the bubble burst, and we were at about 13,500. Now, we're not even in the top 20 or 25 now, based on most figures I've seen, but our foreclosures have not really declined. We've remained in the 14,000 range. So the cumulative impact, I would argue, on Cleveland and this part of the country is more significant than any other part of the country. And we have seen, you know, over 100,000 foreclosures, and the impact on the city has been staggering. Cleveland is a city that's been reeling for a long time. In the 2000 census, we came in at about 473,000 people. I predict the 2010 census will show Cleveland under 350. There are entire neighborhoods that, again, these were neighborhoods that were at risk anyway. I'm not trying to sugarcoat this. I've always said to folks, it's not as if these foreclosures took struggling neighborhoods and made them better. But what it did do is it shoved them over the edge of the cliff. It completely destabilized unstable neighborhoods. It took relatively stable neighborhoods, it destabilized them, and it took even better neighborhoods and started to put them at risk, because the collapse in real estate values here, the impact is far-reaching, going beyond the core city. The Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland just released the survey. Sandy Pianalto, that's P-I-A-N-A-L-T-O, talked about it in a speech he gave recently, that said that the average home in Cleveland is on the market for 954 days before it sells. Well, what that really means is there is no market in the city of Cleveland. And in 2008, we know the average home on the east side of Cleveland was selling for 13% of the auditor's value. So we have this destabilization of the city, this basically this emptying out, and what has happened as a result of the core rotting out as badly as it has, and I'll use the core of the apple metaphor, not surprisingly, it's begun to affect the adjoining communities. We've got greatly weakened inner-ring suburbs, especially in the higher percentage minority inner-ring suburbs, where real estate values have also begun to plummet, and vacant properties have become a way of life there. Cleveland, and nobody really knows the exact number, 20,000 properties awaiting demolition. I'm not sure anybody really knows, certainly 15 at a minimum. But now the eastern inner ring suburbs, a suburb like Euclid has over 1,000 vacant properties, South Euclid has over 600, Richmond Heights has about 500, Cleveland Heights has over 1,000, Shaker Heights, once considered one of the most prestigious suburbs in the country, has about 700. Warrensville Heights, Maple Heights, Garfield Heights all have an excess of 1,000. So this, you know, again, I hate to use the metaphor, but this cancer has spread, and the impact on values, we don't really know yet. In 2012, they're going to do this master reappraisal of all the property values in the county, and when they do it, I think the impact will be so significant it's going to devastate funding levels for schools and cities and parks and county governments in a way we could not have imagined possible.
Jim, Tom Krebs, you talked about flipping. Presumably, the one purchaser bought it with an appraisal saying it was X, and then another person bought it with an appraisal of X plus Y. How did
right?
Tell me what you know about the problems with appraisers there.
Well, FIREA, again, you'll have to, you know, anybody could be an appraiser here. The state standards relax, the federal standards relax, and the state has now stepped in. But the reality is, anybody you wanted to pick to be your appraiser could be your appraiser. And there have been well-publicized cases here. One of a man named Mark Kellogg, who's gone to prison for 15 years, he was reported. They reported about Mark Kellogg in a piece done in Newsweek magazine. I think it was entitled Mortgage Madness. And it was reported about this one individual who had become a master. He used the same appraiser, and he would set up a series of buyers who would, as you know, as many people, put no money down. They probably lied on their loans because they had no income, but they claimed they did, and the no-doc loans. So it was a conspiracy involving people at all levels. It involved clearly people on the street level who lied on mortgages, on the applications, appraisers who gave phony values, realtors who knew this was going on, sellers who were getting rich, or buyers who were getting rich, and sellers who hoped to do the very same thing. Then you had the mortgage brokers who were getting their yield spread premiums. They knew this was fraudulent. Then you had the intermediary banks. Ultimately, this all went off to Wall Street with the imprimatur of a great rating from Moody's or Standard & Poor's and Fitch. And it was just one big conspiracy from the beginning to the end. And, you know, all I can tell you is that, you know, I've come to learn in life when everybody is to blame, nobody's to blame. Because, you know, you can go after the guy on the street who committed this fraud, but I sure hope they'd go after the guys at Moody's who look the other way. Look, this didn't require, when I chaired the Finance Committee and City Council at Cleveland, we'd go to Wall Street occasionally to get our bond rating, and I was always stunned at their press, at the level of detail. They would ask me about the city's finances. Anybody rating these residential mortgage-backed security pools could have, with a computer and 10 minutes of time, learned that many of these mortgages were being sold for inflated value well beyond the local assessor or well beyond the local auditor, whatever they call them, depending on the community, had them on the books for. That should have set off a lot of alarm bells, and they could have dug a little more. But as we now know, this made up a huge part of their business in the early part of the last decade. They didn't want to lose market share, and their sharp pencils somewhere along the way got lost.
So, besides Ring, were there identifiable rings of persons going about doing this? I mean, you talk about Kellogg. Others? Seemingly there had to be.
There were hundreds. There were thousands of people. I mean, this was a boom industry. I mean, think about it. You're in this, you know, you're a guy who's struggling financially. You know, all of a sudden you wake up one day and somebody says, you know, you could buy a house, and if you're willing to work with broker A or broker B, a mortgage broker, an appraiser, you know, if we could find somebody. And you know, it was amazing as how many people owned 7, 8, 10 homes because they were told this was their way of the American dream. We'll make you a landlord, you'll collect rent, and you'll get rich. Now, not everybody that did that was corrupt. Not everybody that did that was you know, a really bad person. They were just people who thought this was their way to get their, you know, the brass ring. I mean, I could own a home. I can own a home without any down payment. But I'm only, a domestic. I'm only working at a local, you know, car wash. I'm only working, you know, as a postal worker, number of postal workers. I'm only making 30 or 30. No problem. No problem. We'll get you the loans.
Jim, there's been some dispute as to whether or not these loans were sold or bought.
Sold by who or bought
well, yeah,
by who?
You know, that is, whether or not there is a group of folks who think, Lou Ranieri, one of them, that for the most part these mortgage loans were sold. That is to say, he's looked at areas across the country where essentially the same type of problem repeats itself time and time and time again, leading him to conclude that there were a group of salesmen out there pushing this product on the public, as opposed to a person going around looking for a mortgage to purchase a home to raise his family.
Well, I think at the end of the day, this wasn't people looking for loans. This was loans looking for people. I believe that. I believe that this was a case of so much money in the market, that they were going out and they were aggressively looking for people to provide these loans. That's why they got sloppier and sloppier and sloppier. That's why at the end of the day, you know, you saw, you went from all day, and then before you knew it, you had low down payments, and then you had no down payments, and then you had minimal documentation of income, and then you had no documentation of income.
Right.
So, you know, when Ranieri, I met him once, interesting guy, I read Liar's Poker, that's how I guess I thought I knew him. When Ranieri, I think securitization was one of the most brilliant financial innovations of the 20th century. It freed up local capital, and if it had been done responsibly, it would have been a wondrous thing, because there was nothing more stable or nothing safer than the American mortgage market. So if you're an investor in Australia or in Norway or in China or in Japan, and somebody said, I can give you this instrument and it'll pay like clockwork every month, that's assuming the model of just, you know, 2-3% foreclosure rates. It all worked out, and it worked for years. But then, as I, you know, I said, people realized they could scam it, and they needed a lot of help to do it, but it was doable.
Jim, this is Alexis. What's different about Cleveland as opposed to the rest of the state? Is there anything distinctive about it?
I would put Cleveland and Ohio in a single category. We had a state government that was not home.
Okay.
I mean, you can go 2 hours away to Pittsburgh at a much, much lower rate of foreclosure. You had a legislature there that was more engaged. You had attorney generals who were more engaged. And certainly 2.5 hours away, the tip there of New York, you know, we're 2.5 hours from the outskirts of Buffalo. Virtually none of this was going on in New York State. They had an activist attorney general, a state legislature that wouldn't tolerate it. But, you know, we're idiots. We've had, you know, a really bad state government for years. We finally have an attorney general who I think is the best attorney general in the country. He's been on this stuff since day one, and he was defeated last week.
Can I also ask you, we've heard anecdotally discussions here in Washington that Cleveland never really climbed out of the last recession before it tumbled into this one. And you took us back to an earlier time. Can you just talk about, you know, the periods of time in which Cleveland has been under such stress? In other words, was there something distinctively different about this crisis, or Cleveland had never dug out and it just was in this one?
Okay, you have to. I'm sorry, I had a brain warp there. Start over.
Okay.
The question
so,
is.
Some people have suggested in Washington that Cleveland never got out of the recession before this crisis, right? In other words, it was always down and out, and it just tumbled right into this crisis.
It has historically been a very poor city, and you know they have these lists of cities that have been the poorest cities in the country. If you look at those lists and go back over a generation, they're pretty much the same cities. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've shifted a spot or two. It's not like one day, you know, a city pops up on the list, and I think research will show you that. So we have been historically a depressed city, though, quite frankly, not unlike Detroit, we've had very strong suburbs. You know, there is wealth here, but the city has always been kind of the place where things have been tougher and where the poor have been segregated and the poor have lived. So anybody that makes the argument that Cleveland's kind of been down and out for a long time, they're right. We have been.
So what were the distinctive markers from this financial crisis? Okay, Wall Street blows up. The economic ruin is still there.
It accelerated the foreclosure, and it moved the decay and the decline from the core city now into the inner ring suburbs.
Okay.
That when you take a property in the city that's already on its last legs and go through quick sales and resales, foreclosure and demolition, some might argue good riddance. But the chances are we should have done that before we spent $250,000 of investors' money and moved it back and forth through a corrupt system. So, you know, some of that was inevitable, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. I've started something here called the Land Bank that believes that our best hope is to gather as many of these properties, tear them down, aggregate them for the day when people will live here again, because I believe that day will come, maybe not in the next, you know, a few years, but it will come. But it not only did it destabilize the city even further, but now it's really moved this decay and this destabilization to the inner ring suburbs, where if you look at where the statistics were of 10 years ago, the percentage of foreclosures in the city were probably 2-1, city versus suburbs. That has now flipped. A much higher percentage of these foreclosures occurring in town now in the suburbs. And that's because there was so little left in the city. The same creeps who were making outrageous, overpriced, undocumented loans in the city realized that there was the getting was just as good, if not better, in the burbs. So it's weakened really the city and the entire region.
Can you talk about what has happened to the health of the lenders who were involved in these loans? Were they state-based, or what happened?
The lenders that made these loans were really from all over the country. The worst here, I testified in Congress to this, was a subsidiary of AmeriQuest called Argent Mortgage. Mm-hmm. Argent wasn't even around in 2002. This was our friend Roland Arnall. He started a company called Argent in 03, 04, 05, and 06. Argent Mortgage, again, remember, Argent Mortgage went from being not even in business to leading in two categories here in their first year: mortgages made and mortgages in foreclosure. In their first year, they were making more mortgages than anybody else in the county. They were also being foreclosed at a higher rate. Now, you think that might have tipped off rating agencies to not make money available to Argent, but they did. They did it in 04, 05, and 06. So, but there were plenty of others, and that data is available.
Right. So the worst of the predators, in your opinion, was AmeriQuest and Argent.
Well, they were at the very top, but they had help from a lot of others. I mean, if you go to the site called the Implodometer, I always chuckle when I go to it because I see all the banks that went belly up. A lot of the banks on there were familiar to us. They're familiar to people here in Northeast Ohio.
Right.
Jim, let me interrupt. Right. You used the term just a moment ago, yield spread premiums to brokers as a method of compensation, and I understand what that is, and everybody here does. But for the record, can you tell us your impression of yield spread premium compensation is?
Sure, it's a legal kickback. It is an amount of money that's monetized at the close of the loan that in effect rewards the mortgage broker for putting a buyer of a new home into a loan package that is probably not in the best interest of the borrower, but is in the best interest of the lender and creates real monetary value. For example, adjustable rate mortgages and a variety of other mortgages that are more likely to add to the bottom line of borrowers, of the banks. So yield spread premiums, when a broker says, I want to help you get the very best loan I can, and maybe the best loan on that day, given your FICO score was a 30-year fixed at 5.2, but he convinces you that because of a little hiccup in your credit score a few years ago, then maybe you're better off taking an adjustable rate mortgage, because right now you can get this at 4.4, and who knows? Rates are likely to go down. You can always refinance later. Anytime you're talked into a product that moves you into an adjustable rate mortgage, or what we refer to here, especially product in 05 and 06 called explosive arms, you get monetized for it. You make money for putting people in loans that they didn't deserve.
Right. How much time do you have for us today?
Not much. We were supposed to do this, with all due respect to you folks, at 11:15, and I'm up against a lunch I have. I mean, I don't mean to sound smart, but I mean, I've got another 6 minutes.
All right. So let me ask you a couple quick questions here then.
I mean, we could do it again, or you know, can you just hold? Would you be willing to hold for a minute? Because the call I got here, just can you bear with me for one second?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Hold on one second.
I need to ask specifically who he talked to in the...
I don't know, we're on the record, but...
I need to ask who he spoke to at the Fed and the whole process of who he went to.
Because
he's seen this whole thing happen.
That's good.
And because he's one of the few people that can really tell us.
Yeah, I do have another 6 or 7 minutes. I'm sorry, I wanted to check to make sure.
Okay, well then let's do the best we can here. And I have a really specific and important set of questions I want to ask you. When you went to the Fed first in 2000, you thought you were going to get some help. You did the conference in 2001. Please try to tell me everything that happened and who you think was opposing efforts to do something that could help Cleveland.
I don't, you know, it's only been 11 years, 10 years, so all I can tell you is that, and I somewhere around here I have a copy of the program, and they tell you who discussed what and who did what. I think I believed, and again, I was naive, I believed that there would be a report fed back to Mr. Greenspan and the folks in D.C. That would result in, you know, some action being taken under the Home Ownership Equity Protection Act, something that would have clamped down on these non-depository lenders, something that would have said, you know, you've got to stop these kinds of practices.
Right.
But I know how naive I am now. I mean, that was kind of quaint, actually, that I believe that.
Were you led to believe that you might be successful, and if so, by whom?
Oh, the Fed is very obtuse. No, they didn't say to me, if we have this conference, we guarantee there'll be action. You know, and again, I got to tell you, it's Tom, right, Tom?
Yeah, that's right.
It'll be 10 years in 3 months. I mean, you know, I don't remember what I had for breakfast. I mean, I can look and see what my program was. I mean, look, I get the general sense of it. We were all there. We said, you know, we need help. These practices are destructive. We just so happened to have two national experts, both teaching at Marshall Law School. One was, you know, was this Kathleen Engel. The other is Patricia McCoy, who is now working with Elizabeth Warren on the Financial Product Safety Commission committee, and who just so happened to be a classmate of mine from Oberlin College. So we hit real firepower. We had some really smart people in the room, and we had the evidence that this thing was doing damage.
And why?
Anyway.
And what did they tell you over the years about why it couldn't get fixed? What did they tell you? Pat McCoy came and testified. I think she was in the Consumer Advisory Council of the Fed, so she was actually at a number of Fed meetings. What did they tell you about why there was?
Patty left. Patricia left not long after for a new appointment in Connecticut. So really, Kathleen Engel was who I spoke with a lot, and my sense of it was that they just didn't think this was a problem. In fact, I remember debating somebody once in the Mortgage Bankers Association on a national public radio program who said, look, this is not a national problem, it's a Cleveland problem. It's a problem that's, you know, we're experiencing in Cleveland because of a bad economy. And I remember responding to them, why the hell do you keep making loans here? If that's really the case, then why do you continue to make loans in the community where you know there's a better likely than not these loans are going to go bad? I never got an answer, and ironically, that man, Mr. Duncan, went to work for Fannie Mae. So I guess he works for us now.
Is that Doug Duncan?
Yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
What happened when you brought this to your state legislature's attention? I don't understand. Why didn't they jump on it?
Because they were completely dominated by bank lobbies. Completely. Totally. And they only jumped on it in the fall of 2006 because this had become such a horrific problem, such a forest fire that had ravaged communities, both urban, suburban, and rural. And only then did the legislature, completely dominated by the Republican Party, act on closing some of these loopholes. Ohio was one of the only two states in the country, Virginia being the other, that didn't allow somebody who had a bad mortgage to seek for relief under the Consumer Safety, the Ohio Safety Product Commission Act. In other words, if you had a bad toaster, you can go to your attorney general. If you had a bad mortgage, you're out of luck. And it was kept out of that by banks. But anyway, yeah, we finally got reform, but it was way too late. And by the time they passed all those reforms in late 06, you know, as you know, this had become a national you know, conflagration that was, you know, it was too late. I mean, it was just something that even state legislatures at this late date could do nothing because most of the damage had been done. You know, markets tightened up by 07, 08. There was no lending being done, but all the damage really had been done up through the end of 06.
Right. Could you tell me about the role of Ney and Bonner?
May.
Ney. You know, Congressman Ney, N-E-Y.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know Ney, and I know is it Boehner? I always pronounce Boehner. I have no role. I mean, I don't. They're Southern Ohio congressmen. I know a lot of the congressmen. I used to. They all lost last Tuesday. I knew a lot of the congressmen in this part of the state, Northern Ohio, but I really had no impact of the others. And I would tell you, for the sake of disclosure, my wife is a congressional assistant. She's a licensed social worker who, about 3 years ago, went to work for a congressman named Dennis Kucinich. She's in his local office here. She does casework for folks who walk in with issues and problems, and I end up testifying in a number of committees. Used to, on a subcommittee headed by her boss, who was very, very active in trying to work with us on these issues, especially most recently the hardest hit funds, and also trying to work with us on getting the rules to be changed by the Department of Treasury as to how money might go to counselors. And the other person that was really helpful to us on one matter was George Voinovich, who worked with me in getting he and Senator Stabenow to pass a change to the IRS code that didn't penalize people who were able to get a mortgage modification. You know, we've been running a foreclosure prevention program out of this office since 06, and part of the problem we were having is that people who did get mortgage modifications were also getting a statement at IRS time saying that that $80,000 reduction in mortgage constituted income. So we were able to get Voinovich and Stabenow, the senator up in Michigan, to pass a change in the IRS code.
Right. I had just your lawsuit that you brought against the 21 lenders.
I didn't bring that, and I didn't agree with the strategy. I know that it's pretty much failed, so it's produced a nice documentary for a French documentarian, but I was part of a group looking for a way to get to banks, but didn't agree with the path they took. There's a guy named John Relman that does these. Yeah. Based on civil rights violations. He did one in Baltimore, which I guess also fell to defeat. But I didn't like the tack they took. It was a public nuisance theory or something along that. I forget what it was, but it failed.
Yeah. Listen, I want to go back to one thing. You said anybody could become an appraiser. Was there any regulatory agency at all in Ohio?
I think there was nominally. But I have to tell you, I'm not exactly sure. It's under the Department of Commerce, but they were so weak, so ineffective, it might as well not have had one at all.
Can I ask you a question about loan modifications?
Yeah.
We hear a lot about some of the impediments to regionally in states. What kind of impediments do you see or have you encountered to successful modifications?
Well, first of all, as a rule, they're a disaster. They don't happen. Hemp, we're the fourth least effective state in the country on hemp until banks in this country come to grips with the fact that they're sitting on a multi-trillion dollar loss. Until they come to grips with that fact and they're prepared to modify mortgages and bring them into line to what properties are really worth, this is just a giant waste of time. Loan modifications are virtually impossible to get. You can talk to the counselors here. We fund many of them. I work with them on a regular basis. It's just a nightmare. You get passed from A to B to C to D. Hemp has had minimal effectiveness here. Bottom line is, you know, we need cram-down legislation. So somebody can go to a bankruptcy court and say, this $150,000 mortgage is no longer worth $150,000. It might be worth half of that. In some cases, a third of that. So why wouldn't you compromise the principal loan balance to what that property is worth, keep the person in the home, and minimize the hit on the bank and the investors? And I've heard the moral hazard argument till I'm blue in the face. Don't go there with moral hazards with me. I mean, we can go to moral hazards if you're prepared to make accountable the people who fed this machinery for years and look the other way on the obvious abuses. So, okay, fine. Let's not modify mortgages. Let's continue to act like these hundreds of billions of dollars of losses don't exist. Fine. It's inevitable. They're going to be realized sooner or later. The difference is if we do them sooner, we'll give some of these communities a chance to stabilize. If we do it later, the banks are going to lose the money anyway, the communities will continue to destabilize, and there'll be nobody home in a lot of these urban areas.
So I need to, you said, I know you're going to go, and I'm worried about getting something that you said to me on the record here. When I asked you how it was, how things were in Cleveland now, you said, basically, the situation is so bad, you said, it's over, it's too late. I just want to, do you remember saying
that? Yeah, it's for many Cleveland neighborhoods, this is a war that has been lost. It's not like you can go. Part of why, and you can go to the internet and look it up, we established something called the Cuyahoga County Land Reutilization Corporation passed the state law back in 08, December. I think it might be the best of its kind in the country. You know, it is a now what response to this crisis that says we've just got to get on with the business of tearing these houses down and clearing vast tracts of land for what will be a new Cleveland someday. I'm a big believer in global warming. I think that by the middle part of this century, there will be people flocking back to this part of the country because we have something very critical. It's called water. And I think we have an obligation to the next generations to get this land aggregated in a way that makes sense. So I'm a big believer in tearing everything down you possibly can because the impact on property values has just been, again, unbelievable. I mean, you're talking to people I do every day. I won't be for long. I'm out of office in 7 weeks. But who, you know, are living in a street with 25 houses, 12 of which are vacant and 4 of which are burned. So, you know, the only hope for those neighbors is getting all of the bad stuff down and seeing if you can't reimagine that neighborhood with fewer people in a different footprint.
Jim, I know you have no time. We do want to talk to you a little bit more because there's a lot of information that you have that we think is critical for it to get out. Because this is some of the first times we've been hearing it on your level. Well, ordinarily everybody's telling us about this really large national and international look.
Or how CDOs actually work, or how much they made in compensation when they did a CDO squared versus a CDO.
But we need more of this, how it affects Main Street or how it gutted Main Street.
Yeah, well, I'm available here. I'm available at 2:30 today. If you want to call me back, I'm available.
I'll call you back at 2:30.
If you want to call me at 2:30, because I'm going to Denver. I'm part of a group that's looking at what a company called Forest City did with Stapleton Airport, which is you're trying to get ideas about what do you do with thousands of vacant acres. Now, we have a lot of vacant land here. Unfortunately, like I said, it's not contiguous, but I'm going to go to Denver anyway to take a look at this, and we'll see what happens. So call me back at what time?
2:30.
Okay, I'll see you here.
That's Central Time or Eastern?
Well, let's see. It's almost 2:15. How about you call me in 2 hours and 15 minutes, which is whatever time that is.
Right. Okay, got it.
Got it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good lunch.
Bye-bye.
Off the record.